went into school, you know, being kind of ready to read, and school went pretty good for me. I was able to do well. And do you know how sometimes in elementary it's like a race? They hand you the math worksheet and it's like a race to see who's going to turn it in first. You know, I was always, you know, one of the first few that would try and do that. And it was a blessing. Besides that, I grew up in a really tiny community, about 12,000 people, and in my small town in Kansas. And I kind of thought that the way we did things was the way you were supposed to do things. So anybody that did something different than my family did, I kind of was like, you know, what's wrong with them? Smoking was a good example. No one in my family was addicted to nicotine, and I didn't like the smell. So I know me and my brother would kind of clown on people and look down on them. And we didn't understand that, you know, it's a very hard habit to break, that many of the people continuing to smoke it couldn't stop. Even though they tried. I found lots of reasons to look down on people. I remember making fun of kids as early as first grade that didn't have clothes that fit. I mean, when I was in first grade, and they were too. Or they didn't have good hygiene. I mean, it's really mean. I think as I grew a little older, I mellowed out, but and I began to have compassion and treat people better, at least normally in public. But then I got married, and the pattern repeated itself. I felt that the way that we had done things in my family in Kansas was a better way to do things than the way that my wife had and her family had done them in Minnesota. And I'm sure she would have appreciated it if I had shared this with her before we got married. But I didn't do a good job of that. And, you know, as I reflect on the early years of our marriage, and sometimes still today, this pride and arrogance about my way is the right way. Have you ever had that experience? It's a character defect that runs deep in my DNA, I think, and it seems to rear its ugly head at the worst times. It's like a default setting on your computer. You know, I frequently feel stuck in that mode, and if you're like me, if there's something in your life or in your personality or in your relationships that you wish wasn't there, then you can identify with the struggle of mine. I wonder this morning if you can think of an area of brokenness in your life. Maybe it's impatience. Maybe it's pride like me, or maybe it's something else. You've worked on it, but it's tough, isn't it? It's frustrating, and I don't know about you, but I want to be healed from this pattern in my life. And healing can be a process, but I'm coming to you honestly today saying it's still a struggle. Today we're going to work our way through a passage and see what Jesus did when he encountered someone who had been struggling with something for 38 years, almost as long as I've been alive. Somebody who needed healing. Somebody who felt stuck and helpless. Somebody in a rut who encountered Jesus. Now you can open up your program or you can turn in your Bible. The scripture is in either place. And we're going to look at John chapter 5, the first 15 verses. Let's start with verse 1. Sometime later, Jesus went up to Jerusalem for a feast of the Jews. In a couple of the other gospels, the other narratives about Jesus, we see one long progression with Jesus he was born where? Bethlehem, which is near Jerusalem. But then he became what? A what? Well, he became a Nazarene later, but not until after he became a refugee. Yeah. He became an Egyptian. Jesus was a refugee in another culture in Egypt. For we don't know how long, a few years. And then he and his family moved back, but they didn't feel safe being close to the seat of power, and they moved north to Nazareth. In John, what I was going to say is that in the other Gospels, there's a movement from Nazareth, where Jesus started off his ministry, where Jesus had grown up, down to Jerusalem. And the story as it's told in the other Gospels is that Jesus pretty much did the baptisms, did the healing, and moved down towards the city where he was ultimately killed. And there's maybe one or two movements. There's one or two journeys of Jesus from the north side, the country, down to the city. In John, the pattern repeats itself about four or five times. You see, as you read through John's description of Jesus' life, that Jesus keeps going from the country back to the city. And normally, it's for a celebration. Jesus seems to like to party. Every time there's a feast, every time there's a get-together, he says, I got to be with the family. I got to be with everybody else. I want to go. Now, I like to go to parties. I bet you like to go to parties too. It's not a surprise, but it's an emphasis in the Gospel of John. Jesus was on the move. Jesus is doing what Jesus does, taking advantage of those gatherings, building relationships with people. It makes me think of our opportunity in our own community. You know, we live on Holly Street, corner of 46th and Holly in the Rainier Valley. At the other end of the block is the Rainier Senior Center, their Southeast Seattle Senior Center, right on the corner of Rainier Avenue and Holly. And the Block Watch meeting meets there once a week. I'm sorry, once a month. And I have gone before, but I realized as I was preparing this message, you know what? That's the kind of thing that Jesus would have gone to if Jesus lived at my house. He would have said, oh, the community is gathering, the Block Watch. All the neighbors on this street go down to that meeting so they can talk about how we can keep our neighborhood safe. And I'll bet you that that's the kind of thing Jesus would have gone to. Anybody joined any kind of community group that's not your normal kind of church small group? It's something I think Jesus would have done. Now let's continue the text. Verse 2, now there is in Jerusalem near the Sheep Gate a pool, which in Aramaic, which was the other language Jesus spoke, is called Bethesda, and which is surrounded by five covered colonnades. They're kind of like pillars with like a canopy. Here, a great number of disabled people used to lie, the blind, the lame, the paralyzed. Now, you've probably heard this story before, but the theory was that this pool had special healing properties. And what would happen is the reason that a great number of disabled people came to lie at the pool called Bethesda was because they believed, and apparently experience had proven out, that the first person to jump into the pool, when the water was stirred, suddenly have you ever been to a hotel where there was a hot tub? And they had a little button on the wall. The hot tub's just completely flat, right? And somebody says, hey, go push the button. And all of a sudden, you know, the little air starts bubbling out and the jets start kicking up and the water is stirred, right? Well, it was like that. Now, they didn't have a button on the wall. They believed that an angel would come and stir up the water and the first person into the pool got healed. Now, you can imagine that a great number, it says, of people would lie around the pool. And can you imagine? I don't know how big the pool was, but it must have been like front row seat, right? Everybody wanted to sit in the front row, try to get in this pool. It was kind of like a lottery for the disabled, right? Who's going to get in first? Who's going to win the lucky ticket and be able to get in the water? What strikes me is that Jesus goes to the city for a feast, and there's a lot of places he could have hung out. Wouldn't you think you'd have found Jesus at the temple where the religious people were? Where did he end up? He ended up where all the broken people were. Not only would he have gone and joined the Block Watch, I think that he probably would have gone to the center across the street on my corner from the senior center is a senior assisted living facility for people who can't take care of themselves anymore. I bet Jesus would have visited there too if Jesus moved into my house. Well, one who was lying there, verse 5, had been an invalid, so he couldn't move by himself for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there, I want you to pay attention to that verb, to see. If you spend very much time with the Gospel of John, you're going to see over and over again the word see. It's a very important verb in John because so often, have you ever heard the expression seeing is believing? Well, it seems to show up in John, that theme. In fact, in John chapter 1, Nathanael comes. Philip found his friend Nathanael, brought him to Jesus. Nathanael comes and says, you know, Jesus says, oh, I know you. And he says, how do you know me? You never met me before. And Jesus says, I saw you while you were still under the fig tree before your friend Philip invited you to come. And he's like, oh man, this dude's psychic. And he knelt down and he said, Rabbi, now I can see that you are the king, that you are the king of the Jews and you are the Son of God. And Jesus told him, he said, you believe because I told you I saw you. In other words, you see me, what I just did, how I knew where you were at, and you believe. And he says later on, blessed are those who believe without seeing. And there's this whole thing between seeing and believing all the way through John. So Jesus saw. There's seeing that gets done by us, and there's seeing that gets done by Jesus in the Gospel of John. It's a big theme. In fact, 39 times in the first six chapters, John, who's writing this, mentions seeing or looking. And that's just the first part of the book. Well, Jesus saw him, he really noticed him, and he learned that he had been in this condition for a long time. That kind of struck me as funny too, because, whoa, how does Jesus need to learn anything? You ever think about that? What, Jesus learned? Do you mean Jesus didn't already know? I thought Jesus knew everything. I'm just going to leave that one there. You can do what you want with that one. I don't have an answer for that. Except, you know, you read at the end of Luke chapter 2 that Jesus grew in wisdom and stature, meaning his physical body, and in favor with God and man. It was like Jesus grew up and matured. Apparently, we say Jesus was fully divine, he was fully God, but he was also fully human. So we can't explain it, we don't understand exactly how it worked, but Jesus grew in wisdom. Jesus learned more and more. The human side of him still had a lot to learn. And so he learned. How do you suppose he learned that this guy had been there for 38 years? Any ideas? I think he probably asked him. Maybe somebody else knew. Maybe his disciples nudged him and said, hey, dude over there, he was here when I was a boy. He's still here. Look at him. I don't know. But I think Jesus probably said, hey, Marvin, what's your name? Except he probably would have said Jesus. What is your name?
Sam.
It's good to meet you, Sam. I'm glad you're here today. You know, it was like that. Jesus was so relational. He was always hanging out with people. Can I move this? I feel like I'm over on one side. Jesus interacted with him. And I think Jesus has compassion on those of us who are struggling with something that just keeps getting us down, with things that trip us up. In his case, 38 years. Jesus didn't just heal him, which we'll see about in a minute, but he also engaged with him. He asked him, hey, how long have you been here? And the next question is really, really wild. This is the end of verse 5. He asked him, do you want to get well? Duh! Does this not seem like a silly question? I mean, I don't want to call Jesus dumb, but isn't it kind of a, well, dumb question? I'm not so sure. See, I think that we grow dependent sometimes on our vices, on those things that we get used to doing, those patterns in our life that aren't healthy for us. We grow attached. It's like people, well, maybe I'm meddling now, but do you know some people that have to have coffee or have to have a soda at a certain time of the day? You know, even if it's not good for them, they still have to have it. They're attached to it. And I think sometimes that happens with us. I heard a youth speaker when I was your guys' age. He was challenging me, you know, as a teen to live a life full on after God. And he was talking about some of the obstacles to living a holy life. And he said, some of you guys, you just love your sin too much. I don't remember very much else about his talk, but I remember that line because I've identified with that a number of times where I'm like, yeah, I'm kind of like that. I just love my sin too much sometimes. It's like a comfort zone that I get in and it's hard to break out of. There's actually a part of us, I think, when we choose to give something up, when we say, Jesus, I hear you saying, I see that you have your finger on this particular part of my life and you want me to change. When we say yes to Jesus, we actually lose that thing. We actually feel the loss of it. We're like, oh, I'm sad. I would like to do that, but I said yes to Jesus and I'm not doing that anymore. And it's a process to grieve that. So Jesus asks him, do you want to get well? And what does he say? Does he say yes? No. Does he say yes? No, he doesn't say yes. What does he do? What does he do? He's like, sorry, can't really do it. He makes an excuse, right? He says, everybody else gets in. I can never get in. Doesn't work for me. And I think we all have a zillion reasons. A zillion, I don't know how many a zillion is, but I mean, I think it means a lot. Lots of rationalizations for why it won't work for us to say yes to Jesus and be healed of our brokenness. You know, he didn't realize what an opportunity he had when Jesus asked him, do you want to get well? He's just like, oh, no, I'm kind of stuck here. Just can't do it. Yeah, have you ever seen Winnie the Pooh? This guy reminds me of Eeyore. I don't think I can make it in the pool. I'm too far away. When the angel comes down, I can't get ahead of all those other people. I'm going to be here forever. Maybe I could do radio voiceovers, do you think? I was talking to our new president at Seattle's Union Gospel Mission, where I work, about this struggle to overcome addiction and long-term patterns in our lives. And he said one thing that helps him is to remember how God can't stand sin and that it separates us. It creates distance between us and God when we do choose to do the wrong thing. He says, if I remember that God abhors sin, you familiar with that word, to abhor? It's like, it's like, oh, no, I don't want to do that. It's like, one time you touch the hot stove and you get burned, and the next time you come up and you actually just feel the heat, you get a little bit close to the stove and you're like, whoa, I remember. I'm not touching it. And he said, it helps me to remember that God abhors sin. He like draws away from it. And if I remember that God's like that and sin keeps me away from God, then it helps to keep me away too. It's also because we want to be in relationship with God and we don't want to be separated. I tried to break it down into something really easy to remember. And one way I think of it is abhor sin, adore Him. Can you say that? Abhor sin, adore Him. It's kind of a 1-2 punch. It's creating a new thought pattern in our mind that says, no, I'm not going to go down that same pattern, that same road again. I don't want to touch the hot stove because it doesn't deliver. I thought that doing that pattern in my life would keep me safe or make me happy or give me what I want, but it never does. It doesn't deliver. And Jesus is amazing. I want to be close to Him. I adore Him. I'm ready. I'm ready to leave this behind. I'm ready to grieve losing it and learn to live without it. Abhor sin, adore Him. So Jesus, verse 8, says to the guy, get up, pick up your mat, and what? Walk, yes. At once the man was cured. He picked up his mat and walked. So Jesus takes authority. He has the power to heal. Jesus didn't heal everyone, but He chose to heal this man, told him to get up. At once he was healed. He said yes, an amazing healing happened right there on the spot as he obeyed and responded to Jesus. Jesus said, get up, take up your mat and walk. And he chose, I think, to get up and pick up his mat and walk. I suppose it's possible that he could have stayed down. It's interesting to me that Jesus not only told him to get up, but he also told him to walk with his mat. Why? Why did he need to carry his mat with him? He didn't want him to litter? Just leave it laying where he had had it? Here's my theory. I think Jesus wanted to show us that we take our situation, we take our reality, we take our circumstances, our pain with us when Jesus heals us. And God gives us an opportunity to tell our story to other people. Because when we have that mat under our arm, it tells people where we used to be. And we then have an opportunity to tell others about what Jesus has done. That's just my theory. I, for example, get to tell people about how Jesus is helping me to overcome my arrogance and pride and selfishness as God helps me take steps forward on that. Now, the day on which this took place, this is continuing in verse 9, the day on which this took place was a Sabbath. And so the Jews said to the man who had been healed, "It is the Sabbath. The law forbids you to carry your mat." And here we get to the religious rules. See, the Jews accosted Jesus. They said, "Hold up." All right, not Jesus, but they accosted the man who had been healed. They said, "Wait a minute. We don't do it this way around here. We have a set of rules. We have a tradition. To follow God here, you have to conform and do it the way we do it." It's like in my neighborhood, some of the students have trouble going to church because the ushers, it's very important to the ushers that the worship happen in a particular way. And so they're telling the teenagers when they come in, "Oh no, you have to pull up your pants. Oh, take the hat off. Take the hat off." You know, it's like you can't come in here like that. This is a similar thing. I wonder if there are any parts of our church tradition here at SFCC or at my church at Rainier Avenue that has become sort of a law that might be getting in the way of reaching broken people or getting in the way of even our own growth. Jesus didn't look at it that way. He said, "You know what? The Sabbath is to serve. And it's okay to heal on the Sabbath." We see Jesus getting in trouble for this multiple times in the stories in the New Testament. And Jesus is like, "Oh, no, the Sabbath isn't created for man, but man for the Sabbath." He said, "We were created to rest, but also to serve." And I want you to know that when I come here, I notice many of you serving. And that makes me happy. And I think it makes Jesus happy. So thank you. I see you rotating up here in worship and in leading all the different roles that you serve here in the English congregation. So congratulations. It's awesome. I read a quote this week by a writer named E. Stanley Jones. And he said this. He said, "To obey commandments is to obey an inspired morality." Morality means knowing what's wrong and right, right? He says, "To obey commandments is to obey an inspired morality. You shall not." Like the Ten Commandments, right? "But to follow a person," Jones says, "is to do the things that he does. And to do the things he does is as inspired morality." I think I wrote down the quote wrong. It shouldn't have been inspired the first time. "It comes from within when you're following a person, and its source is love. One is a legal morality." That's the first one. "The other is a love morality. One is artificial. It's something that somebody kind of made up, the rules. The other is artesian. It's like a spring that springs up from within us. One binds you. Oh, I have to do it this way. I got to try my hardest to get it done, right? And the other one is freeing, to follow Jesus and try to live like him. One makes you tense and gloomy like Eeyore. And the other makes you relaxed and spontaneous and happy. I hope that we can have and practice that inspired morality rather than the legal morality." So the Jews come, they jump the guy's case and say, "You can't carry your mat." And he replies, "The man who made me well said to me, 'Pick up your mat and walk.' That's why I'm carrying it." So then they ask him, verse 12, "Who is this fellow who told you to pick it up and walk?" And this is crazy. He had no idea. Why? Because Jesus had slipped away into the crowd that was there. So Jesus and this guy have a brief conversation, and suddenly Jesus just vanishes. He is gone. So the man was healed, but he didn't know. He didn't recognize the power or the name or the person of Jesus. Jesus didn't stick around. You know, I can only imagine what kind of a zoo it would have been with all the other disabled people there. Once they saw what Jesus did for him, wouldn't there just be like, you know, everybody's like, me too, me too. Can I get some of that? Whatever you gave him. Do you have any more? So Jesus decides he's just going to heal this one guy, and he slips away into the crowd. It reminds me of my experience growing as a Christian. Have you ever been to a camp or a retreat where you just got on fire for God and you were like, yes, this is what I want to do with my life. And I'm saying yes to God. And then you come home and it's like still all the same at home. And while you were on this high when you were at the retreat, when you get home, you're just like, oh, it's not sticking. I wish that it would last. It seems like Jesus just slipped away when you got home. I've had that experience. I don't know if you can identify. But watch this. Later on, Jesus finds him. Jesus slips away. Jesus comes back and finds him. He was looking for him. He wasn't done with him yet. And I don't think he's done with you and me either when we get home from a retreat or a camp. Later, verse 14, Jesus found him at the temple and said to him, see, you're well again. Stop sinning or something worse may happen to you. Where did he find him? At the temple. For 38 years, he had been at the pool, right? And now he's healed. They had rules about who could come into the temple. And suddenly he's able to go back and to worship. It's amazing. He's giving, he's serving, he's back in the mix. And Jesus meets him there. And you want to put yourself in an environment where you are likely to meet up with Jesus. So I am glad you are here. This is a good place to meet up with Jesus. That's why at the end of those camps and retreats, the speaker always tells you to stay plugged in with your small group, with your pastor, with your devotional life. Jesus exhorts this guy. He pushes him forward to the next step. He tells him, stop sinning. Stop the broken pattern. Now, for him, apparently, it wasn't just being an invalid that was an area of brokenness. Maybe it was the Eeyore kind of thinking. I don't know what it was, but Jesus challenged him. He said, stop doing things the way you've been doing them. Maybe he was a bully at the pool. I don't know. I can tell you this, though. We have a lot of disabled folks in our church. We recently cut off the sides of the pews to make room for all the wheelchairs we have. In spite of the pain and the suffering that they endure, some of them are as full of joy as anyone I know. They're just amazing to be around because they love Jesus so much and it just radiates from their personality. Several of them actually serve as our ushers because you just can't not be happy when you interact with them, and that's the kind of person that we want where people come in, right? But I have also interacted with people that were disabled that would come Sunday after Sunday and be just about as miserable as you can imagine. No fun to be around. Just like us sometimes, right? Stop sinning, Jesus says. What else would Jesus say? Do you think he's being harsh here? Why would he say, stop sinning? What are the wages of sin? In Romans, right? The wages of sin are death. That's what we earn. We get death when we sin. It kills us inside. And Jesus' heart for this man was for him to change his behavior, to change his attitudes, to change his life patterns and his thinking patterns that didn't honor God. And that's exactly what we need from God when we come to meet him here at this temple. We need him to put his finger on our broken places and heal us. And we need his exhortation to change, his empowerment to become different. And Jesus, something worse may happen to you. It sounds like a threat almost. Again, it's like, man, what is Jesus doing? Something worse may happen to you? Well, what is worse than death? He said, if you keep on sinning, it's just going to get worse. when we keep on sinning, it kills us. We die a bit more each day. Some of us think we can get away with it because what we're doing, nobody knows about, just us. God says, you think it's not hurting anyone? Oh, it's hurting someone, all right. It's going to catch up with you. You will reap what you sow, and there are consequences of sin. Even if you're forgiven, even if God's grace covers all our sin, which it does, God doesn't always remove the consequences of our behavior. And that can be costly, because sin really does hurt us. Sometimes there's generational brokenness that occurs, like in the case of fetal alcohol syndrome, where the behavior of the parents cripple the healthy development of the child. There's patterns of control where the parent squeezes tight on the child, so the child rebels, right? And one person's brokenness impacts another person's brokenness. If you think that you can keep the area of your life that's broken just the way it is and be just fine, I want to tell you this morning, it's going to hurt somebody sooner or later. Jesus is very serious when he says, don't sin like that anymore. Because, well, you remember the really short saying, what was it? Abhor sin, adore him. Here's another really short one. Maybe it's a little bit edgy, but I'm thinking it's true. Sin sucks. Sin sucks the life out of you. It sucks hope and love and happiness away. So Jesus is very serious when he puts his finger on our area of sickness and says, get up, pick up your mat, walk, stop sinning, or something worse may happen to you. You guys, there's a Jesus who loves you, a Lord who wants your life to get traction, to move forward, to make an impact on other people. And Jesus wants you to go to the temple and meet with him here every week, and he's going to keep reminding you to walk. The man goes away, verse 15, and told the Jews that it was Jesus who had made him well. So now Jesus reintroduces himself. He says, oh, you're Jesus. And he goes back, and it's crazy because he tells on him. The Jews were the ones looking for him. The guy already knew they weren't very happy with what Jesus had done. Jesus just healed him and said, get your act together. And then he goes back and tells on Jesus. Huh? Wow. He just got healed by this guy. Now he's going to go tell on him? I don't understand. I think he was trying to get in good with the authorities, with those who were after Jesus. And like many of us do, he tried to exploit the situation for his own good. He wasn't thinking of Jesus' good, but of how to advance his own position. I want to encourage you that it's a process, this healing thing. We're not always going to get it right. Just like this guy, I think, kind of blew it as soon as Jesus healed him. He went out and blew it. But I don't think Jesus gave up on him, and I don't think that Jesus gives up on us. I think he's going to give us enough space to grow in our relationship with him. So this morning, I just invite you to think of this story and think of yourself in it. Maybe you're like the guy laying by the pool. Maybe you're struggling with some part of your behavior, something inside that you don't like or understand. And Jesus says to you, do you want to get well? Maybe you don't feel like you have anything like that in your life right now. And that's great. But I wonder if Jesus is calling you to go hang out at the pool with people that are struggling and point them to Jesus. Maybe you've been more concerned about the rules than about relationships and healing. You have the gift of scorekeeping, and you give people grief for not doing things the right way. I wonder if Jesus might want you to walk along with those of us carrying our mats and learn about Jesus from us. Let's pray together and ask God to convict us, to put his finger on what it is in our lives, or to show us how to respond to this story, because this is an amazing story, and I hope that something in it has captured your attention. I hope that before you go to sleep tonight, you will be thinking about what it looks like for you to say, yes, I want to be well. God, thank you for this story. Thank you that John preserved it. He wrote down what happened when you showed up at the pool at Bethesda, where all the broken people were. And God, we want you to show up here this morning because you know I'm broken. You know the character flaws that I am continuing to struggle with. God, thank you for the ways that you've shown me how I can take steps forward in that. And I just know that I'm not done yet. And I pray that you will continue to help me. I pray that for each of us, that in the areas where we struggle, God, that we will be able to take the next step and do the next right thing. Help us to stay in community, to stay accountable on these areas, to talk about them with our families or our friends. Help us to say yes to you. God, help us to go to the places like the pool where there's a lot of broken people and to stand with them and get to know them like Jesus did and to point them to Jesus. And help us not to be so concerned about the rules that we forget about the relationship. Help us to abhor sin and adore you and not let sin suck the life out of us. In Jesus' name, amen.